Welcome to SD Podcast. On this podcast, we continue our conversation with Dr. Jeannie Marazzo, who is Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at the University of Washington. Topic of discussion is pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention, or PrEP. PrEP provides antiretroviral treatment to people who are HIV negative and at high risk to become infected with HIV. For example, if they are in discordant partnerships where the other partner is infected. Welcome back to the podcast, Jeannie. There are now 5 studies on PrEP that have been completed, 4 of which have shown very promising results and 1 study not showing any efficacy. What can you tell us about the VOICE trial so far?
Yeah, thanks, Case. Good to talk with you again and good to talk about PrEP. So for those of you who aren't familiar with VOICE, I will just remind you that this is a study of approximately 5,000 women who were randomized to 1 of 5 arms. It's a study that occurred in sub-Saharan Africa, in Zimbabwe, Uganda, and South Africa. And the 5 arms that women were randomized to were all daily use of a study product. And those arms included oral tenofovir tablets, oral Truvada tablets, oral placebo tablets, vaginal placebo gel, and vaginal 1% tenofovir gel. And the idea here, as Case mentioned, is to provide daily antiretroviral pre-exposure prophylaxis to prevent HIV infection. And these were young women, reproductive age, throughout those countries that I mentioned. The study completed enrollment in June of last year, and in September of last year, so September 2011, we had an unscheduled Data Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB, and that took place in response to the very, very encouraging results of the Partners PrEP study, which, as you may know, studied oral PrEP with Truvada or tenofovir in HIV serodiscordant couples, so basically daily use of either of those products or a placebo in the HIV negative member of serodiscordant couples, and that was in Kenya and Uganda. And Partners PrEP had the very big and wonderful surprise in July, early July, that they had remarkable efficacy in preventing HIV acquisition in the uninfected partner. The efficacy for both men and women for both tenofovir and Truvada pretty much ranged between 65 and 73%. And those data are soon to be published, so people will be able to take a look at this. So we had a DSMB in September because we in the DSMB, our DSMB, felt like we should evaluate where we were and VOICE. And much to our surprise and disappointment, that evaluation revealed that the daily oral tenofovir arm in VOICE was not going to be able to show any positive prevention in those women, and in fact, that oral tenofovir was not effective in the women enrolled in VOICE. So those arms were essentially closed out. The Truvada gel arm, the tenofovir gel arm and the oral Truvada arm continued. We then, in November of 2011, had another DSMB that was a regularly scheduled DSMB. And at that DSMB, we had, perhaps to me, even the more surprising finding that the tenofovir gel arm was also not effective in preventing HIV. And so basically, it was a determination of futility. And in fact, the HIV incidence rates in those two arms were almost identical, 6.0 and 6.1% for the tenofovir gel arm compared to the placebo arm. So a really very big and surprising, disappointing determination that pretty strongly contradicted in some ways the findings of the CAPRISA study, CAPRISA 004, which was the study reported by Qureisha and Slim Abdul Karim from Durban, South Africa. That was a study that, of course, had women use pericoidal dose of the very same product that we were using, and they showed a 36% reduction in HIV acquisition in those women. I will point out, though, that the confidence interval around that estimate went as low as 6 and as high as, I'll have to look it up so we can come back to that. But it was a very wide confidence interval, and there's no doubt that the confidence interval that we will have in VOICE will probably overlap with that, although we don't know what that is. So in some statistical senses, these studies were not contradictory, although clearly not the result that we wanted to see. The oral Truvada arm is continuing, and we will complete that follow-up in women on the oral Truvada arm and the corresponding oral placebo arm in June of this year. So we anticipate that the study results will probably be complete by early 2013, if not slightly before.
So, Jeannie, how do you make sense of it all? I mean, yours is the sixth study, I think, that's really looking at this, and you have these really very efficacious studies on one end, and you got disappointing outcomes on the others. How do you look at that? How do you reconcile these differences?
Well, if I could answer that, I would be very much sought after. I mean, where are we at? I can tell you, we have contradictory findings on efficacy. The other studies that we haven't mentioned very briefly are the SEMPREP study, which was also a study of reproductive age women that was just studying oral Truvada and oral placebo. That was stopped for futility, exactly the same number of infections in each arm. And then you have the TDF2 study, which was a study in heterosexuals in Botswana, which showed results very similar to Partners PrEP, and they studied Truvada as well. So you've got FemPrep versus Partners PrEP and the TDF2 study, and then you've got Partners PrEP versus Voice with regard to tenofovir, and then you've got Caprisa 004 versus Voice with the tenofovir gel. I think it's very confusing, and the only way we're going to be able to make sense of this is going to be very careful comparison of the pharmacokinetics as an objective marker of adherence. I think that's going to be very, very critical, and really a careful comparison of the populations. Populations have been very different in these studies. In Partners PrEP, you know, in these serodiscordant couples, both members of the couple were enrolled and were consented. So there were no issues with disclosure. There was very strong support within the couple generally for each other's participation. Incredible compliance, incredible adherence, both by self-report and by other markers. Clearly, that's not the population that we have in Voice. We've got a lot of young women in South Africa. The majority of our population, the majority of those women are not married, are not in partnerships that they would report necessarily as stable. And we've had some challenges with male partners in terms of them understanding the reason for their female partners to be in the study and supporting them. And one might question the consequent effects and differential effects on women's adherence to product. Again, we don't know if that's the case, that this was all about adherence, but that certainly is one hypothesis. We will have objective measurements of product use in the form of plasma, drug levels, hair, actually, drug levels. Hair is a great way to measure whether people have been using product over the long term, and also genital tract samples. So we'll be able to look at that, and I think it'll be really important. What other things could be different here? Well, you know, the background incidence of HIV in the populations is really different. In the Partners PrEP study in those discordant couples, their background incidence of HIV was 1.9%. And I think I mentioned in our tenofovir gel arm and the placebo gel arm, it was 6.1%. So, you know, you have to sort of think of that as a reflection of what these women are facing when they are encountering someone with HIV. When you've got such a high incidence background, I'm pretty sure you've got a lot of people who have very high viral loads in the population, very, very high rates of primary infection. And it may be that the bar is very, very high for preventing infection with PrEP. The other thing is that background incidence of herpes is probably very different in Partners PrEP. Again, these couples have been together for a long time. For the most part, they were considerably older than our women. In Voice, the age is quite young. It's about 23 to 24, depending on where you are, for the median age. You know, the incidence of herpes simplex virus infection in the Caprisa study was 22% in the placebo arm. And I suspect that in Voice, it will end up being similar. So, you know, it just really may be that the confluence of events that put these women at risk for HIV is unique and is really a reflection of just the raging epidemic, particularly in South Africa. And then finally, you know, we just don't know enough about other genital tract characteristics that may affect susceptibility that may have been different in these populations. Besides herpes, there could be disruption of vaginal microbiota. There could be different sexual practices in terms of anal versus vaginal sex. So a lot of things to be assessed, I think, before we can say anything.
Now, on the other side of sort of the research spectrum here, a major study was released this summer, HPTN-052, that showed that putting HIV-infected people on highly active antiretroviral drugs dramatically reduced the risk that they passed the infection on to their partners. So it's kind of the flip side of the PrEP trials, if you will. So if early treatment of persons with HIV is as effective in preventing new infections as this study suggests, what would be the place of PrEP for prevention, even if it was shown that PrEP actually works?
Right. So this is something that is very much on everybody's mind, because I don't think that any one approach is going to work for every single person who's either infected or at risk. Clearly, if you are a young 16-year-old HIV uninfected woman in Durban who may or may not have a lot of choice about who her sex partners are, treatment for prevention is not something that she can control to change her risk. It really is going to rely on the infected person, particularly when it comes to vulnerable women, the infected man, to take responsibility for. So while I think it is an amazing, amazing advance and clearly was effective and just incredible, I think you need to recognize the limitations, both at the individual level and also at the implementation level, which people, of course, are very sensitive to, the limitations of getting medications to people, even at lower CD4 counts, even with PEPFAR efforts, sustained country efforts, has been gigantic. So I think the way that people are trying to look at this is how to fit these pieces of the puzzle together best. Is PrEP going to be most effective in serodiscordant partners, given Connie and Jared's partners in prevention data and the TDF2 data, where the HIV-infected partner may not be ready to take ART or may not have access to ART and still has a very healthy CD4 count? That's one possibility. How that translates to a different population, so for example, young men and young women who are uninfected but really want to protect themselves, I think really has to be discussed at the local level, discussed with people who would use the products, and discussed with people who are going to have to pay for them. So it's an incredibly complicated discussion that I think many governing bodies and people are really, really involved with. There are a number, as I think you know, of combination prevention projects now underway, both as demonstration projects and as larger randomized community trials that are being designed and probably be started in the next year or so. So I think a lot of questions to be answered, just really exciting to finally have some tools at our disposal beyond circumcision and condoms.
So finally, there is concern that the widespread use of heart or antiretroviral treatment for prevention will increase the likelihood of resistance and thus problems coming down the road. Do you share this concern?
I think it's an important theoretical concern. I think it's something we can't lose sight of. I always remember the malaria model, which is a great example. When people started using their best drugs for prophylaxis, that's really when we developed chloroquine resistance and all kinds of problems. I think it's really important, and clearly the ideal goal is to have separate products, ideally even separate classes of drugs, that you could use for prevention and really preserve sanctity of the drugs that you use for treatment. I do think that should be a goal. One of the attractive things about local delivery, in particular with microbicides or rings or other delivery methods genitally, was that maybe you would be able to avoid systemic exposure to the point where you wouldn't be as likely to get resistant virus if you did get infected. We don't know that, but that's, I think, a theoretical possibility. So I think we need to keep working towards having those goals partitioned and really having different meds. Are we there yet? I don't think we are. And the question is, can we wait until we've got those drugs? I don't think so. So there's a window here where we can use something like tenofovir, which admittedly is a really big part of our routine treatment, try to blunt the likelihood of infection, all the time thinking that we would really like to develop a new generation of drugs and a new generation of delivery system to maximize the likelihood that we will not see resistant virus.
Just to clarify, when you said local delivery, you meant like vaginal gel delivery?
Yes, vaginal gel, vaginal gel or rectal gel or vaginal rings. There's a very intriguing study that's about to start later this year that will look at the Piverine rings. The International Partnership for Microbicides has been developing that product for a long time, and the Microbicide Trial Network is going to be starting a study, MTN-020, that will randomize women to a ring that will be worn for about 28 days, similar to the contraceptive ring that's available now. And that has dapivirine, which is an NNRTI, as opposed to an NRTI, which is tenofovir. So a completely different class of drugs with a completely different delivery system. And I think that's where we're going right now, to really start looking at not just different products, but also combination products, which would be a great way to reduce the likelihood of resistance. People are also putting maraviroc, which is a CCR5 inhibitor, into general products like rings and gels to try to see if that actually makes more sense as a prevention method given at the site of infection. So I think a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, some disruption by the voice results in terms of tenofovir gel, but I think, you know, really can't totally yield to disappointment until we know what happened and can try to explain it. And I think we just really need to keep our eyes on the ball and recognize that there is a role for PrEP. We just got to figure out why this didn't work. If it was in part that people didn't use it, we have to figure out how to get people to use these products if they're effective and make them acceptable.
Dr. Jeannie Marazzo is a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Washington and a principal investigator on the VOICE pre-exposure prophylaxis trial. Thanks for speaking with us, Jeannie.
Thanks, Case.
SD Podcast is produced by Ben Westergaard. This is Case Riekmeyer for SD Prevention Online.